From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The special session to pass a Florida budget goes on and on and on.
There is a bit of fatigue from some of these legislators. They've been here, they've been doing a bunch of different things, and they just want to get the budget closed out and get done.
Also this week, the matter of Florida's new congressional maps passed by lawmakers and signed by Governor DeSantis is by no means a fully done deal.
Is it only right that the individuals who live in that community are represented by somebody out in that community?
We'll also dig into what began as a rumor that Alligator Alcatraz may be shutting down, and we'll take a look at a plan to restore the natural vitality of Florida's tidal areas. I'm Tom Flanagan. On air and online, this is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Week two of the Florida special session on the budget is over, and lawmakers have still not passed a budget. Tristan Wood spoke with Politico Florida's Gary Fineout and the Florida Phoenix's Christine Sexton about what's happening in Tallahassee, what's taking them so long, and how the process has grown more opaque in recent years.
Thanks, Gary and Christine, for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
So first off, what's the Capitol been like over the last 2 weeks?
Well, this past few days, it's been eerily quiet. I mean, a lot of lawmakers went home after the budget conference committees from last week wrapped up. They're holed up in their offices. They've been bringing in meals because you can smell it around lunchtime when they've been bringing in food into the Capitol.
That's a product of them doing this budget during a special session, right? That's not typical. How has that kind of changed this process?
Well, when they do the budget during a regular session, it's a lot more hectic and harried and what have you, because what you have to kind of squeeze in the budget negotiations while they're dealing with everything else. This time they left town in March. They still didn't have a budget and kind of kept waiting and waiting. And then they finally reached an agreement over sort of what we call the top level spending amounts. Not intricate details of the budget, but just sort of like they have to start with the first premise, which is how much money do we have? How much can we spend? And what areas are we going to spend it in? And so then the first week of the special session is they had what they called budget conference committees, which are panels made up of lawmakers from both the House and Senate. They get together and they go over offers in their particular subject area. Now, these meetings last all of 2 to 3 minutes. There's paper exchanged. There's, we'll look at your offer. We'll get back to you. And then at the end of that, they say, okay, anything we haven't agreed on is then, quote, bumped to the budget chairs.
This conference process, it used to be the process where it was the hot ticket. Right? All the lobbyists are there, the members are there, and they would publicly discuss some of these things. They would say, you know, we're funding this, and line item 51 is this, you know, this study would accomplish this goal. And I feel like over the last several years, it's become this exchange where members meet for a hot moment, they exchange paper, there's no public discussion, you get up and you leave. And everything is discussed, it feels like, behind closed doors.
Why do you think those changes have come? Why do you think the process is like this now?
What I have been told is there is a bit of fatigue from some of these legislators. They've been here, they've been doing a bunch of different things, and they just want to get the budget closed out and get done. And so, you know, and I think the other thing, I think this also reflects the fact that the legislature, especially over the last 5 to 10 years, most of the decision making has been even more concentrated in leadership than it was before. I do want to note that this is not just reporters noting this. You had this past week, you had the governor of the state of Florida come out and make a comment in which he said, oh, it seems like there's a little cabal that makes all these decisions about the budget, and we don't know anything until the white smoke comes out, making a reference to how a pope is selected.
Now, we're talking about the state budget and all these negotiations between these politicians. Why should an everyday person care about this?
I know for many people, the budget can seem like it's arcane. How does that affect my life? Well, it affects your life in a lot of different ways. Everything from healthcare, how much money local school districts are going to get from the state.
On that a little bit, what are some of the sticking points that they're, back and forth on or separated from that would impact like everyday Floridians that you guys have been paying attention?
Everglades restoration money. There's been a big disagreement as to how you handle vouchers. Basically, the Senate wants to make sure that the amount of money that's set aside for private school vouchers is listed separately in the education budget. For a variety of reasons, the House wants it all rolled together. Another thing that's kind of out there for some people, at least in the immediate vicinity of Tallahassee, is going to be, what kind of pay raise package is going to be put together. Is it going to be across the board? Is it only going to be selective people like first responders and law enforcement that get a pay bump? The House and Senate have already said that they're not going to increase health insurance premiums for state workers. But there's other stuff like that that's still all of sort of in the mix.
My first focus, though, is what I think is a focus for Perez, which is funding for the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. It usually doesn't get the attention that other state agencies get. This is an agency that advocates would say has been long underfunded. It serves people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who require healthcare, community-based healthcare services if they need to stay out of an institution. I guess one last program, and it got a lot of attention during the regular session, was ADAP. That's the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. And this has not really been in the budget offers back and forth that we've seen to date. You may recall that the legislature put about $31 million in there as a temporary stopgap to prevent the DeSantis administration from eliminating thousands of people from the program. So the legislature agreed to some stopgap funding, but that funding expires at the end of the year, June 30th. So people who advocate for AIDS programs and the need for them, they're hoping for the best, but this is a very large unresolved issue that really no one's been talking about publicly.
I know a lot of ink has been written about like the fighting between leadership in the two chambers, and is that what's driving the stalling, you think, or is it fundamental disagreement on those unique issues? What do you think is driving kind of it stretching out?
I mean, that's the problem with the way the process is right now, is we don't really know all the ins and outs and details. And what's likely going to happen is they're going to come out and they're going to say, okay, this is what we're offering. And then the other side usually says, okay, we'll take that except item X, item Y. And you have to kind of try to ask questions but sometimes you don't find out what some of the real disputes are until after the fact. I know that there's been a couple of times that reporters have like tried to go in and make public records requests and get text messages and stuff like that. And they discover that all of a sudden that there was a beef about something that never was ever publicly discussed.
Not to ask you guys to read like tea leaves too much, but that there's this situation with budget. But the other thing that's looking to come this year is kind of the property tax special session. Do you feel that how long this is stretched out, what omens do you think that gives for how smooth that special session is going to be?
Well, I really think it depends upon the proposal that gets finally released by the governor. I mean, that's essentially where we're at with that, is that basically it is anticipated that the governor will release a proposal at some time in the future ahead of a special session. And then the question is, how does the Senate and House view that proposal? Do they accept it as is and pass it and put it on the ballot? Or do they want to tinker with it? I think the governor wants to get something on the ballot this November. The deadline to do that is early August. I think all signs are is that there will be a special session in some point in time between now and August. And a property tax proposal will be debated and discussed and, you know, theoretically voted on. It's going to take a supermajority to get it onto the ballot. You know, and so can they craft a proposal that you've got enough votes for?
Thank you both for your time. I really appreciate it.
And this just broke as we were putting this edition of Capitol Report together. Florida House Speaker Daniel Perez sent an email to his members today saying conference meetings on the budget would resume and possibly wrap up on Tuesday. That's the day after Memorial Day. If that in fact does happen, the new budget would be on members' desks, actually available electronically, that afternoon, and that would start the 72-hour cooling-off clock ticking. The full legislature would then be back in Tallahassee a week from today to vote on the budget and adjourn sine die. Florida's drug overdose deaths continued to decline in 2025, according to recent state data. Opioid-caused deaths fell by 42% from January of 2025 to June of the same year, and fentanyl-caused deaths fell 46%. That's according to the Interim 2025 Drugs in Deceased Persons report that's released by the Florida Medical Examiners Commission. U.S. Senator Ashley Moody credits law enforcement for cracking down on drug smugglers and dealers, as well as proactive efforts to help those who are addicted.
You have to have not just law enforcement efforts in terms of interdiction or going after these poison peddlers. You have to make sure that those addicted are not going to keep seeking out drugs.
The number of fatal drug overdoses has dropped over the past 3 years across the country, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. About 70,000 Americans died from an overdose in 2025. That was the lowest number since 2019, and a decline of about 14% from the prior year. Coming up on Capitol Report, there's no official word yet, but there are many signs that Florida's notorious alligator Alcatraz detention facility may be on the verge of closure.
We are ready to jump back into court in early June and continue our fight until we know for sure that this project is dead and will never come back.
And we'll see what it takes to bring a critical coastal area back to a cleaner and more natural state.
Each adult oyster can filter a lot of water, you know, up to 50 gallons a day. So it's good for the health of the bay.
Detractors of Florida's new congressional maps say redrawn districts threaten to topple a part of the state constitution aimed in part at preventing partisan gerrymandering. Miami Gardens Democratic Senator Chevron Jones argues that so-called race-neutral map drawing undermines meaningful representation for Black and Hispanic voters. He talked about it on the Between the Lines with Derek Ham podcast from State Affairs.
Do you think in Florida that we need, that Black voters need those protections any longer?
No, I think the danger is us even having this conversation, that this national conversation that's happening, even this whole idea of race neutral, because when you look at the maps that Florida, that the governor just put forth, it's race neutral for who? Because when you're talking about representation and you are compacting individuals within a community, and you're splitting those communities up. And I'm talking about, let's use Central Florida, mm-hmm. Which is a predominantly Puerto Rican community, but you now split them in into four. Isn't it only right that the individuals who live in that community are represented by somebody in that community? What is the problem with having multiple people sitting at the table who represents multiple different types of individual? And if the governor was sincere in his comments when it comes to talking about race neutrality, that I would. I would believe him if he can make comments like where white men feel as if they are being discriminated against, or this is for that particular group of individuals. I think that is a slap in African-American people's faces who have been fighting true discrimination within this country and even within this state. So the idea that the maps that has been presented to us and that has been voted on by the legislature to suggest that individuals of a certain community should not have that type of representation I'm not going to say it's not fair, because I think that word has gone out the window. I would ask individuals who believe so strongly in this race neutral aspect, how would you feel on the other side if you were represented by an individual who was not from your community, who did not know your needs, who never lived your lived experience and could not speak to those lived experiences in the Congress or even in the state Senate or even within the Florida House? Those type of things matter.
That was Democratic State Senator Chevron Jones on the Between the Lines with Derek Ham podcast from State Affairs, and you can listen wherever you get your podcasts. The Immigration Detention Center in the Everglades, known as Alligator Alcatraz, is reportedly preparing to close next month. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford talked with Elise Bennett, Florida Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, about the purported timeline.
Your organization, Friends of the Everglades, and the Miccosukee Tribe all joined forces to shut down this detention facility immediately upon news that it was being built back in the summer of 2025. Now, almost a year later, we are actually hearing reports that the facility could be shut down rather imminently. When did you first hear this news?
Well, the news had been trickling out for a while. We had been hearing that folks were being removed from the site and taken to other facilities. We were seeing flights landing and taking off. And so it wasn't until last week when the New York Times broke that there were actual official conversations going on that we started to get a better picture of what was occurring and the fact that this facility may finally be closed and soon, within the end of the next month.
What is your reaction?
We filed this case and our motion for a preliminary injunction before they ever brought one person onto that site. And we did that to try to prevent environmental harms that we've proven since then and that are ongoing now. So we're disappointed because we fought for this to happen sooner. We're relieved to hear that it may finally close, but we're not going to let up. We can't, while Florida's most vulnerable remain at risk. And the fact is, until we know for sure that it's closed and all the harm is remediated, we can't stop.
Have you been made aware of what the reason is behind this closure, the sudden closure, assuming it happens? We've heard reports of operational costs upwards of $1 billion and a cost of $1 million every day to run the facility.
I've heard the same, though I haven't seen any official documentation confirming that. The thing that comes to my mind is that we've demonstrated in court and we continue to observe this overwhelming and irreparable environmental harm. And seeing these reports begs the question, for what? A sadistic political stunt that will be the source of national shame for our children and our grandchildren? An opportunity to deny constitutional rights to people who are here in our country, to violate federal laws? The fact that none of those reasons were enough to shut down the facility, but that it came down to, you know, mud on their face and high costs for taxpayers is really disappointing.
Now, how does the closure of this facility impact your litigation, which stems, as you mentioned, from allegations that both the state and federal government broke environmental laws with the hasty construction of it in the Everglades with really zero environmental studies whatsoever being done?
Yeah, well, I'll note that the reported timeline of this closure is interesting because the plan is to have all detainees removed from the site just days before we can jump back into action in district court and amend and supplement our complaint and move forward with our environmental claims. And the fact is that there is still work to be done to ensure that the federal and state government remediate and preserve the site so that something like this never happens again. So we are ready to jump back into court in early June and continue our fight until we know for sure that this project is dead and will never come back.
Now, you've also filed litigation to get records regarding the funding, the amount of money that was spent, and where all those dollars came from. Can you give me an update on the status of those efforts?
So that litigation was filed by Friends of the Everglades, our co-plaintiff in the environmental case, and they continue to receive records from that request that we are reviewing and making public as we get them. We also have many records requests to the federal government as well. Unfortunately, those responses have been slow walked, and we are still working to get that information, which is going to be incredibly valuable to continue to piece together the picture of the full extent of the harm there. We already know that that harm is overwhelming, but there are many details that we know we're likely not aware of just yet. So even beyond fighting in this case in court to stop the project and get the site remediated, we will also be fighting to get answers to the questions that so many Floridians and people across the nation have about this facility and its impacts.
How would you envision this deconstruction to take place? Would that happen rapidly, would you think?
We don't know. And part of that is because the federal government didn't comply with the National Environmental Policy Act. Generally, the government would have to come with its full plan, not just the setup, but also the takedown, because from the beginning, they've claimed this was going to be a temporary site. So there would have been a thoughtful plan put in place for how are we going to remove all of the human waste off of the site? How are we going to remove jet fuel? How are we going to make sure that nothing is spilled or runs off of the site? All of those questions would have been thought through and answered by experts who manage these kinds of waste and these impacts to the environment. But because the federal and state government pushed ahead without complying with their own federal laws, we are stuck in this boondoggle where we kind of have to, you know, build the plane while we land it. And that doesn't mean we're going to back away and we're not going to try to restore the site, but it shows the reason that these laws exist and why they should have been complied with in this case.
That was Elise Bennett of the Center for Biological Diversity with WGCU's Jennifer Crawford. Florida's increasingly crowded waterways had 694 boating accidents last year. That was up from the prior 2 years, according to a new state report. The annual Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's Boating Accident Statistical Report also shows there were 51 fatalities last year. That was down from 81 deaths in 2024. Drowning was the leading cause of death, according to the report. Monroe County, which includes the Florida Keys, had the most boating accidents last year, while the most deaths occurred in Lee County. FWC officer Chris Boley says boat captains always need to pay attention to their surroundings.
It's important you know all the navigational rules and you keep, you know, your head on a swivel, because while you might know all that stuff, all the other boats out there, you don't know if the boat next to you is a seasoned captain with thousands of hours of experience or if it's someone who rented a vessel for the day and it's their first time on a boat.
The state has nearly 103 million registered vessels and up to 1 million non-registered vessels actively using Florida waters. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida has the longest coastline in the contiguous United States, with about 8,500 miles of tidal shoreline. While a waterfront view seems idyllic, the reality is communities are dealing with the pressures of rising sea levels. Global warming has elevated Florida's waterline by 8 inches since 1950, and it's expected to keep growing. For NPR's Climate Solutions Week, we're looking at a nature-based way of stabilizing the coast. It's called Living Shorelines. WUSF's Jessica Mazzaros reports public officials have been taking the lead on this initiative for about a decade.
Mesh bags filled with oyster shells are stacked to create a barrier between Old Tampa Bay and red mangroves at Philippi Park in Safety Harbor. This is called a living shoreline. It's the opposite of a hardened shoreline, which uses concrete or other material to build a seawall. Stacy Day with Pinellas County heads up this effort.
We know that there used to be oysters in this part of the bay.
So they're reviving that population. Oyster reefs along the shore help to break up waves and prevent the land from eroding. Plus,
each adult oyster can filter a lot of water, you know, up to 50 gallons a day. So it's good for the health of the bay.
Pinellas has 8 living shoreline projects at this park alone. One of them is an offshore oyster reef, which Day says helped minimize flood damage from the hurricanes a couple years ago.
It didn't move at all in the storms.
It's not just oysters. Living shorelines can be made with sand, rocks, and plants. And these natural barriers get stronger as they get older, unlike traditional seawalls, which weaken over time before ultimately crumbling. That's the case for one 50 miles south at Rose Park along Palmasola Bay in Manatee County.
The seawall is very old, and where we're standing today, you can see the giant cracks and you can see the rebar that is in the old concrete that was used to establish the wall.
Sherry Swanson with the county says this seawall didn't stop floodwaters from submerging the park during Hurricane Helene in 2024.
The storm water came over the seawall and it went into the park, and some of the trees were killed by the saltwater and other ones were knocked over by the wind.
Now, Manatee is replacing this seawall with a natural slope made of oyster bars, artificial reefs, and native plants.
And then the waves will be able to gently roll up the slopes versus crashing into these abrupt seawall edges that are currently here.
Another 40 miles south at Blackburn Point in Sarasota County, I walk on shells. The Gulf water is lapping onto red mangrove trees. Armando Ubeda of Florida Sea Grant says where I'm standing didn't exist 10 years ago.
You wouldn't be able to stand at this spot because it was a big drop.
The county used coconut fiber logs to build out the non-existent shoreline. They added mangroves, oysters, and loose shells. The project is considered a success.
The shoreline is being restored, basically. The soil is in there. The park is still here. And we're getting more people coming now, fishing and doing things, so it's great.
So far, most of Florida's living shoreline restoration has happened on public lands by local governments. There's more than 30 reported across the state. But Ubeda says there's a huge missing piece to this resiliency puzzle.
We need private homeowners to get involved.
Residents own more of the state's coastline than their governments do. So Ubeda's team published an informational website. They also offer a course that teaches people to navigate the design and permitting process. And a new state law passed this year helps streamline the red tape. I'm Jessica Mazzaros, reporting from Florida's Gulf Coast.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Derek Hamm, Jennifer Crawford, and Jessica Mazzaros. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Hope you have a happy and safe Memorial Day weekend, and we invite you to join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.